Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 285, the Three Georges Gold Saga and a Bottle of Mampur Vignette. Farming dominated the State Afrikaanse Republic economy in the 1880s, even after gold was discovered in the Eastern Transvaal. But everything is about to change. Last episode, we heard about the early goldfield finds around Rustenburg, which was part of the Witwatersrand Ward back in those days. Farms along the ridge of White Waters, the Witwatersrand, had a fairly steady supply of water courtesy of the many springs that could be found along the ridge. Still, the freezing winters and the lack of wood meant the region was not in high demand, despite water and fairly good soils. By 1886, dozens of diggers began arriving on the Witwatersrand, having heard reports of the earlier finds and growing tired of the limited options available in Pilgrim's Rest. Others made their way from the south, from Kimberley or the coast, trekking on foot. Two of those were the Georges I mentioned in episode 284, George Harrison and George Walker, who walked from the Orange Free State and decided to chance their luck in Barberton. If it were possible and we teleported ourselves back to this time, we would have come across hundreds of other fortune seekers tramping across the countryside, determined to strike it lucky. George Harrison is a bit of a mystery. He was Australian, or perhaps more accurately, an Englishman who lived in Australia and joined the gold rush there. He failed to find any treasure, then read about the Eastern Transvaal, Barberton and Pilgrim's Rest discoveries and made a beeline for South Africa. We don't know much more about Harrison's origin story. George Walker, on the other hand, had quite an extensive CV. Born in Wigan, in England, in 1853, he made his way to Kimberley in 1879, but had little luck digging for diamonds. He joined a British cavalry contingent during the Anglo-Zulu War. He fought in Zululand, after which he rode off to Pilgrim's Rest and Kaapsehoop to dig for gold. Meanwhile, coal had been discovered in large quantities in the Free State, and he first took up a job at the Witrand coal mine near Kroonstad, where he met Elizabeth Johanna Katharina Pretorius, and the couple married in 1883. It was there that George Harrison bumped into George Walker on his great trek from Kimberley to the Eastern Transvaal goldfields, and the two decided to try their luck one more time at Barberton. George Walker left his wife Katharina and their children in Potchefstroom and joined Harrison for their trek to Barberton. They broke their journey on the Witwatersrand, deciding to earn cash to set themselves up with a wagon and horses and the other necessities before heading on to Barberton. It just so happened that the Struben brothers were looking for builders around the Confidence Mine, which, as you heard last episode, was somewhat of a misnomer. Walker was hired to erect a stamp battery to crush ore for the Strubens, and Harrison was advised to head off to Widow Oosthuizen's farm nearby. She wanted to build a house for her son and his family on her portion of the farm Langlachter, a few miles south of Confidence Mine, and she hired Harrison. It's ironic that Fred Struben, who had worked tirelessly for most of his adult life searching for the mother lode, innocently pointed Harrison in the general direction of the greatest mineral discovery the world has ever known. Sit back for a moment and consider the scene. A landscape of openness, the open veld, a few acacia thorn trees here and there, aloes, some succulents. When gold was discovered on the Witwatersrand in 1886, there was no settlement of any size. The ridge was part of the open high veld. It was a vast, elevated plateau nearly 1,700 metres above sea level. It's an immense, empty and windswept landscape, although it had long been inhabited and used by African farming and pastoral communities. The country was dominated by rolling grassland rather than forest. These days, Johannesburg has one of the largest human-generated forests on planet Earth. The horizon in 1886 was endless, interrupted only by the long, low, quartzite ridges of the Witwatersrand itself. The grass changed with the seasons. In summer, it reached waist height, turning lush green after thunderstorms. In winter, it dried into golden and pale brown waves that rustled in the wind. Frost is common during the cold, dry winters. The air then was clean and bracing. But it was the absence of trees that caused an intense feeling of alienation, particularly for the Europeans arriving on the Highveld. Natural woodland was scarce because of the altitude, the seasonal drought, recurring fires and grazing. Trees could be found mainly along rivers, around the springs, and in some sheltered valleys. Species such as wild olive, kariya, hookthorn acacia, and buffalo thorn were scattered rather than forming forests. Fuel and building timber were therefore precious commodities, often transported from distant regions, or dried cow patties were burned. The eucalyptus, pine, jacaranda, oaks, and other trees that define modern Johannesburg had not yet been planted. The landscape was crossed by numerous seasonal streams and flays, and marshes, wetlands. During the summer rains, these filled with water, creating ribbons of green vegetation, which attracted abundant wildlife. In winter, many streams shrank to pools or dried up completely. As you heard last episode, the name Witwatersrand, Ridge of White Waters, referred to the white foam and cascades where streams flowed over the pale quartzite rocks during summer rainfall. Spring brought carpets of wildflowers, watsonias, aloes, daisies, lilies, countless bulbs that bloomed briefly after the rains. Although the vegetation seemed monotonous from a distance, it supported a remarkably rich ecosystem. Wildlife was still plentiful in 1886, although already declining due to hunting and expanding settlement. Herds of springbok, blesbok, black wildebeest, zebra, eland grazed the grasslands down to where Vereeniging is today. Smaller antelopes such as steenbok and dacre occupied denser cover. Predators included black-backed jackals, caracals, leopards in rocky hills, spotted hyenas in some areas, and occasional lions in earlier decades, although lions had become rare on the central Highveld by the time of the gold discovery. Birds of prey circled overhead, while secretary birds strode through the grass hunting snakes. Bustards, cranes, korans, guinea fowl, francolins, countless smaller birds were common. Wetlands hosted the ducks, the geese, ibises, and herons. The Witwatersrand Ridge itself was rugged rather than mountainous, dotted with hard quartzite outcrops projecting through the grass, their white and grey rocks gleaming in the sunlight. These ridges offered broad views across an ocean of grass extending to the horizon, and the gold-bearing reefs lay hidden beneath the seemingly ordinary surface, invisible except where erosion had exposed narrow bands of conglomerate rock. There were few permanent roads. Ox wagon tracks wound between farms and waterholes and the settlements. Farmhouses were scattered many kilometers apart, surrounded by grazing land rather than cultivated fields. Smoke from grass fires or distant homesteads might be the only sight of human presence across the open veld. The silence was one of the landscape's defining qualities. Visitors describe calm mornings echoing with the call of cranes, the bark of jackals, or the cracking of an ox wagon shambok from a kilometer or more away. During summer afternoons, towering thunderclouds built rapidly over the plateau, bringing dramatic lightning, torrential rain, and the smell of wet earth before clearing to brilliant sunsets, as it does today. It was through this landscape that the two Georges strolled in a steamy February day in 1886. They would have come across some of the ancient sites of villages strewn across this terrain, and like many before them, wondered about their origin. The Witwatersrand, the Sekebosrand, the Magaliesberg Range was far from an empty wilderness when the first trekkers arrived in the mid-1830s. In the decades immediately before their arrival, the area was a dynamic and densely populated landscape shaped by large-scale Sututswana urban centers, followed by the dramatic geopolitical shift of the Difakani or Mfetlani and the rise of Mzilikazi's Ndebele Kingdom. If you followed this series, you'll remember how Mzilikazi Khumalo fled from Shaka, ending up where Pretoria North is today. Before the upheaval of the Mfetlani in the 1820s, the Highveld was home to extensive Sututswana agricultural and pastoral polities, people of the Bakwena, Bakgatla, Batlako, and the Bakwaduba. They built metropolitan stone cities, which confounded the early settlers who believed the large abandoned towns must have been the work of an external force. Contrary to older colonial myths of nomadic pastoralism, these groups constructed massive permanent stone-walled towns. The site at Sekebosrand, which has recently been mapped extensively using LIDAR technology, has been called Gweneng, a thriving Bakwena city that housed an estimated 5,000, maybe 10,000 residents at its peak between the 1500s and the 1820s. If you walk around the Melville Kopjes, you'll come across the Budfontein Molokwani-style stone structures that line the Witwatersrand high ground all along the watershed. You'll find ancient iron smelting sites where the indigenous metallurgists melted iron using clay furnaces, trading the tools and weapons they forged across regional trade networks. Their goods ended up in northern Mozambique and were shipped to Arabia and even India. But they never mined the gold, because it was not alluvial. It was in the reefs, the banquets, hidden away, and almost unworkable unless you had a modern steam-driven crusher. Most of the gold worked by southern Africa over hundreds of years was alluvial, picked out of the rock in Zimbabwe or washed in the streams of the eastern Transvaal. In the 1820s, waves of displaced people from the east and south, like the Puting, the Shakwana, and Sebetwani's Kololo, fell upon these major towns like Kweneng, sacking and burning as they went. Mzilikazi Khumalo's Ndebele followed. Their mode of warfare crushed the Sotho Botswana communities in this region. Survivors either joined the Ndebele and paid tribute or fled west towards the Kalahari margin. Others went south towards the Vaal and Moshoeshoe's Basotho. When Hendrik Potgieter and the other Voortrekker reconnaissance parties arrived along the Vaal and Witwatersrand in 1836, battles followed. Eventually, the Ndebele were pushed out of the Transvaal completely and ended up in Zimbabwe. You know the story. The two Georges, strolling about, would have been aware of the Potgieter saga, but blissfully unaware of the prehistory as they wandered through Langlaagte Farm. Originally 2,260 morgen in size, or about 5,000 hectares, it had been broken up into four portions. In common with other pastoral communities across southern Africa, Boer customs stipulated that marriage entailed a land grant or farm subdivision for every son. The difference is most African communities relied on the king or the chief assigning the land, whereas in the Boers' case it was the grandfather or the father. Portion A of Langlaagte was owned by André Spriet, portion B by Anna Elizabeth de Beer Mulder, her maiden name was Oosthuizen, portion C by Gerhardus Oosthuizen, and portion D by the widow Petronella Oosthuizen and her son Jan Hendrik Oosthuizen. Portion D was where Harrison was working, building the widow's son his home. George Walker and George Harrison strolled onto Gerhardus Oosthuizen's portion C property when they stumbled on a well-weathered outcrop of rock. Being naturally inclined to inspect rocks, they examined the conglomerate, which appeared to have traces of gold. They took a sample, crushed it, and panned the ore like they'd done hundreds of times before, but this time it revealed a long tail of gold. Excited, they both agreed to keep their find a secret and to approach Gerhardus Oosthuizen about being granted digging rights. Fortunately, the farmer was amenable to the idea, despite the two Georges being skint. He was buoyed by the idea that gold lay under his farm. Exciting news! Under President Paul Kruger's South African Republic, mineral law was shaped by Law No. 8 of 1885, the Goudwet, the gold law, which balanced state revenue with private property rights. Roman Dutch legal principles applied, and if you excuse the poor Latin, cuius solum aius est usque coelum et ad inferos. Whoever owns the soil owns it up to the heaven and down to the depths. What it meant was that the farmer owned the gold beneath his fields. If a major reef was struck, the ZAR government proclaimed the farm a public digging. However, the farmer had crucial protected rights through the main pacht, the mining license. They could reserve a portion of around 10% strictly for their own mining or commercial exploitation, and granted priority claims which shielded their homes and outbuildings and cultivated lands from prospectors. The Transvaal state would charge monthly license fees to diggers, but they would have to split their revenues 50-50 with the farm owner. 140 years later, the law regarding precious metals, land rights and discovery is an entirely different proposition. The entire paradigm was dismantled by the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act of 2002, which came into full effect in 2004 and dictates mineral rights today. Private ownership of underground minerals has been abolished. Under Section 3 of the MPRDA, all mineral and petroleum resources are the common heritage of all the people of South Africa, with the state acting as the sovereign custodian. Farmers have zero claim to the gold beneath their soil, nor can they sell mining rights. Instead of drawing 50% of the claim fees, like the Transvaal system of 1886, the mining company pays royalties directly to the National Treasury via the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Royalty Act. Back to the Georges. In April 1886, Gerhardus Oosthuizen drew up a contract with Harrison and Walker, allowing them to prospect on his farm, and if they found gold, the farmer would give them a claim each. They were cock-a-hoop. Finally, their gold-laden ship was going to sail in. But Walker, unfortunately, was also a talker and a drinker. As the two Georges set off to source capital and register their claims, Walker decided to visit his wife in Potchefstroom. As the story goes, and historians believe this is accurate, Walker walked into his local bar in Potch and ordered a bottle of his favourite peach brandy, better known to all of us as Mampoer. Which, of course, like everything else in South African history, has a wonderful origin story, so bear with me a moment. The word Mampoer is widely accepted to be named after Bapedi King Khosi Mampoer II. During a volatile period of conflict involving the Bapedi, rival factions and the Boer Republic forces, Chief Mampuru's people frequently traded with local frontier farmers, the Boers. The Pedi people were skilled at fermenting wild fruits like the marula, and when frontier trekkers brought copper pot stills into the region, a cross-cultural sharing of distilling techniques took place. A little Africa and Europe combination. Boer commandos and locals began referring to the fiery, clear marula spirit associated with the chief's territory as Mampuru's drink, which eventually evolved phonetically into the Afrikaans word Mampoer. George Walker was quaffing cups of the stuff and began babbling away back in Potch. His Mampoer bottle buddy sitting alongside just happened to be, yes, another George, George Honeyball. He was a blacksmith, and he was tiring of the sooty, sweaty life of hammer and tongs, and listened in amazement as the hammered Walker spilled the gold beans. History is strange, all right. Just to add a sense of eerie resonance, George Honeyball was a relative of the widow Oosthuizen of Portion D in Langlaagte. He rented a small house on the farm alongside the bereaved matron. Hurrying back to Langlaagte, Honeyball crushed some ore, but was unable to assay its value. He knew just the person who could help. Yes, our old friend Fred Struben and his co-worker Godfrey Lace. Struben by now had heard every cock and bull gold story and wasn't very optimistic, but Lace took the bait. He offered George Honeyball a few pounds to show him the exact spot of the Walker-Harrison conglomerate. The garrulous Honeyball was onto a good thing. Men would buy him rounds of peach brandy, he reckoned, so he began showing other prospectors the banquet that lay along Langlaagte. It is not clear how happy George Harrison was to hear about that. Just 4 short days after Walker and Harrison had negotiated their contract with Gerhardus Oosthuizen, a rival group of prospectors under the leadership of Saul Jacobs formed the Langlaagte Company to work portion B of the farm. As you'll hear next episode, things from here on are going to move extremely quickly. Prospectors arrived from near and far. Paul Kruger's government was going to be thrown into fear and loathing, and Cecil John Rhodes and other mega-rich men were going to seize the day. As for the two Georges, Walker and Harrison, their story does not end well. Harrison famously took his £10 payout from the widow Oosthuizen and vanished into the Lowveld. Some say he was eaten by a lion, while Walker blew through his modest claim money almost instantly. George Walker spent the rest of his life working as an ordinary miner on the Witwatersrand, living in relative obscurity, along with Katharina and their 9 children. Decades later, in the 1920s, the South African government and the Chamber of Mines granted the elderly and now penniless Walker a small pension in recognition of his role in founding the world's greatest goldfield, an empire he effectively traded away for a few pounds and a bottle of Mampoer. Next episode, the big money players, including Cecil John Rhodes, Herman Eckstein, Lionel Phillips, J.B. Robinson, and Barney Bonatto, arrive to seize control of the goldfields. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform. You can sign up for the newsletter at desmondlatham.blog. Until next, Salagahle.